Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. This is your host, modern dance choreographer, Dana Tassoon Burgess. On the Slant podcast, I speak with prolific Asian American artists, writers, and thought leaders to explore questions about race, identity, and creating in America. Today's guest is my childhood friend, Kevin Stay. Kevin is one of the best recognized dancers in the entertainment world, whose career now spans 25 years. He's been successful in areas as diverse as choreography, modeling, directing, and acting, and has worked with the world's top musical artists, directors, photographers, and designers. It'll be great to check in with him. There he is. Hi, Kevin. It's so nice to speak with you.
Heck, pull up there.
So, Kevin, today you'll be the first guest on season two. So we're really excited about that. And what we decided for season two is that we would make it a little more informal and just have a conversation. And so, Kevin, can I just get started?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, perfect. Well, first of all, I want to welcome you and say it's so fascinating because we had a moment in time where we grew up together a little bit in Santa Fe.
Yes, absolutely. You're very memorable in my mind.
That's so nice. I remember we were in Egla Germanis's English class. I think that's what we were in together. Well, you know, tell us, how did you grow up and where did you grow up?
How did I grow up? Oh, I'm still working on that. I was born in California and in Hollywood and kind of lived all over until moving back to Los Angeles. I went to Michigan, Milwaukee, Santa Fe, Oregon, and Singapore, and then came back to go to college in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's interesting is I remember that when we were in Santa Fe going to high school together, at that time, you were interested in dance, but you weren't sort of formally a dancer. And I was doing martial arts and I hadn't formally started dancing. So it was like an interesting time where I think maybe as a freshman and a sophomore of high school, we were kind of searching for, well, what are we going to do with our lives? And yet you were always very artistic. I remember that you sketched a lot and you had a visual propensity, which I always appreciated as well. So how did you end up being a dancer?
Completely roundabout way, actually. And I know when we knew each other back then, it was not on the radar for either of us. Right. Very not on the radar for me. I think I was in Santa Fe just trying to figure out who I was in that scene, in that world.
And that's quite a scene.
Quite a scene. Every year back then was figuring it out for me because it was like new environments and new communities everywhere I went every time. Mm-hmm. I was doing gymnastics, if you remember, back at high school. And that gave me sort of an awareness of my body. And so when I went to Singapore and started doing gymnastics in Singapore with the gymnastics team, the coach really loved the idea of mixing dance and gymnastics. And so he had a show that mixed the two together and I joined and I loved it. And from that moment on, everyone thought I could dance and kept asking me to dance. So I did.
That's great. Did you have a mentor?
Not until I came to the US and was taking dance class at USC, which I took specifically just because somebody told me that what I was doing was not real dance. And out there in the real world were real dancers and that's not dance. And so I said, well, I'm going to go learn what real dance is and see what this is all about. But once I got there, I started taking classes from a teacher named Mark Lawrence, who had a studio in West LA. And he offered me a scholarship to go, to go to his studio and take whatever classes I could, which was hard all the way across town without transportation. But he really took me under his wing and he was like, drop your shoulders back, you know, plie from here. Like everything was very technically oriented because he could tell that I had the joy of it. And I loved doing more street dance more than technical stuff, but that I needed the technical stuff in order to get it all under my belt. And he was my first mentor for sure.
Oh, neat. Yeah. How did you end up working with Madonna?
She had a cattle call nationwide that was publicized on the news and in papers and Hollywood Reporter and Variety. And looking for fierce male dancers. And I went to that call. I mean, my agent sent me on that as well, but I saw the national call first and went for that. I'm only realizing now how my sort of blind confidence, <'cause> I don't think I was as good as I thought I was at the time. My blind confidence definitely pushed me to the front of the room. It was like, oh, I got this. I can do this. I'll be right up front. I don't care. Like, look at me. And I know that if I had even stepped one row back, just in hesitancy, I wouldn't have gotten the job or been called in at all, because she would look at everybody in groups of 40 and then choose one, and the rest would be cut. So if you're not front and center, she's not looking at you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that's how I got it. It's just being full of myself.
Well, that's great. That's great.
Sometimes that's all it takes. That's all it takes.
You know, what's so fascinating about youth is that, you know, as I grow older, sometimes I think, I look back and I think, how did I have that confidence then? But now sort of I question a lot more things. You know, there's certain things I feel more confident in, but then certain things that I feel like I question a lot more. So it's funny, isn't it, how that wanes or how it ebbs and flows.
So it definitely shifted for me. I struggle recently this past year or two with, does what I have to say make a difference? Or is what I have to say even worth saying? When I think back in the day, I'm like, yes, I'll say everything because my opinion matters to everybody. And now I think in this realm of everybody having an opinion and everybody sharing their opinions about everything, I almost want to withdraw and just like, okay, you know what? No one needs to hear one more voice in the chorus. But I struggle with that because at the same time, I'm like, I know I have a very unique worldview and a unique experience and perspective that should be shared on some level. And if it can give some inspiration to anybody, why am I not out there sharing? So thank you for asking, because for me also, to get me talking, it has me realize sometimes the value of sharing.
Absolutely. And it's interesting too, because when we look at your career and all of the different iconic individuals that you've worked with and that you've danced for, like Lady Gaga, Michael Jackson, Prince, Celine Dion, Cher, Britney Spears, like the list just goes on and on and on. Here you are in the midst of popular icons. And so what does that mean for you? Like, is there a dichotomy between the reality of what is seen, for instance, on screen, and how you feel you're living your life? Or is there a dichotomy between, like, when you see Britney Spears on screen or in the news and you think of her versus actually having worked with her? Sort of the individual versus the industry.
I mean, I think I've been very fortunate in the sense that I've never been a fanboy particularly of anybody, except Prince. I will totally give that one. I've always been a fanboy of Prince, and he's the one person I was geeking out over. but I think not being a fan, I mean, fan's not a bad thing, but fan gives a particular relationship between you and a star. Not being a fan allowed me to work with everybody on a more teamwork level and on a more personal level that I could contribute without just being a sycophant or a yes person nodding my head all the time. And I think people appreciate that and appreciated that on a human level. And I know for myself, you know, it gave me a lot of perspective about the trappings of being an icon and how much you pay and lose to be an international superstar. You really lose your privacy, your time. You have to want it, like really want it, and be willing to sacrifice your time and your life and your privacy for it. So I have a lot of respect for all of them who make it to that level, and not everybody, you know, survives stable or, you know, or sane, because that's a lot to deal with. It gave me a lot of perspective about the value of that for me, which is it doesn't hold a lot of value for me. What holds value for me is doing good work and enjoying myself, enjoying my time with people, being part of a team. I love being in wonderful projects, but it always comes down to the work and not about self-aggrandizement and all that stuff. It's just, it's interesting to watch celebrities from the outside and how the media reports on everybody. because I know how they slant everything and how they, you know, move everything around to fit a certain narrative or to play into a narrative or to troll something or to build somebody up to tear them down. I definitely get more and more, especially now, how media, you know, can just be a total game.
Mm.
And it's not a game that I'm usually willing to play. And sometimes I fall for it. You know, I sometimes fall into the, oh, they're horrible. I'm like, I don't know them. I haven't met them. I don't know the situation. I'm thinking that they're horrible. I'm like, ooh, I need to reserve my opinions.
Yeah.
You know, and really step back from believing what, not believing what you read, but in taking responsibility for how I respond to the communications and input that I receive.
And I remember, like, when you were young, you seemed like an introvert, actually, on some level. And, you know, and yet you had such great communication skills. And do you think you're an introvert?
Yes. I do. It's such a weird thing to say. Like, it's almost like a bad thing, but it's not actually bad. It's just that it takes a lot of energy for me to be social.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy it when I am, but I'm not just blindly social. I can't just go out to a club and like, yeah, I'm gonna have a great time by myself in the corner and meet a bunch of people. Like, that's like, that sounds like hell to me. Like going out to some random place, trying to meet people. Oh my God, it sounds awful. Uh-huh. But if I already know somebody or I'm introduced to somebody, then I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm like, if I'm with somebody I know and I can sort of reach out communication wise to other people around me and meet people that way, I'm totally fine and actually quite good at networking that way. I take on other people's unease. So especially if somebody is uneasy with me or uneasy at speaking with me, I instantly kind of lock up the same way back.
Mm-hmm. So you have an empathic quality to you.
Yes. I work on it because I know it's not real. So I work on it when I'm out. And sometimes it's just sharing that I am uncomfortable and have social anxiety that then allows me to let go of the social anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I work at it because I know it doesn't benefit me particularly to be an introvert. But it's also that I give a lot of energy when I am being social and out with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I give a lot. So it takes time to also to regroup and re-energize and you know, regenerate.
Right. Well, that's interesting because, you know, we see you in, for example, like your recent documentary, Strike a Pose, and you're just right out there and you're like so vulnerable and talking. And so, you know, I think it's interesting for people to understand that there are these different gradated qualities that an artist has within their personality. Can you tell us about Strike a Pose?
Absolutely. I mean, to speak on what you just said, I think there's, you know, people automatically assume if you're in the public eye that you're completely extroverted and that you love being on stage and you love like sharing all and giving all and being completely bare to everybody. And that's not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I share a certain side of myself on stage that's probably, maybe you could admittedly, arguably the most intimate side of me. But, you know, even like, but then you get me into a public speaking realm and I'm like, I can lock up. If I'm not passionate about what I'm saying, I could absolutely lock up and say, I don't know what's going on and like run away. Your follow-up question was?
Would you tell us about Strike a Pose?
Strike a Pose is a documentary that was shot in 2015 that documented and followed the dancers who were on tour with Madonna in the Blonde Ambition tour in 1990, who took part in the film Truth or Dare, Madonna Truth or Dare in Europe, also called In Bed with Madonna, and kind of just caught up with us to kind of delve deeper into our stories of what was going on behind the scenes on tour and then really what's happened since. It's a beautiful film. And I don't say that just because I'm in it. I say that because it really is a beautiful piece of filmmaking. And it comes from a European point of view, which is less sensationalist and definitely leaves questions. They're not trying to feed you information. They're really documenting, observing and sharing our stories. And it's so, so rare that dancers get the opportunity to tell a story mm-hmm. with their voice and their words and to share their life and what happens underneath everything, because what you see out in the world is just one level. We could make four more movies with us. I mean, there's so much more to unpack.
Well, I enjoyed it so much, and it made me think about the finite career of the body, in a sense, and that there are these beautiful moments that become embedded within our memories, within our histories, so to speak. And it's like, because the Madonna tour and relationship to Madonna happened so early in your career, and that was such a high, in a sense, right? It was like at the height of her career. Then how do you sort of move on from that as a young artist and go, oh my gosh, I've got to move on from this moment in time?
I don't know that I really ever defined myself by that job. Again, not being a fan or fanboy definitely helped with that. I never tied my identity to it. Although many years later, that seems to be the thing that people have latched onto as this sort of lasting legacy this made a difference for me. Yeah, I came home and life was just the same as it was before I had left. I was out at the same auditions and experiencing the same world as before I left. So when I came back, it wasn't like, now I'm Madonna's dancer. Like, it wasn't like that. I came back going, oh God, I got all my money and I'm living in my car. And and I got to like prepare and plan for the future and be more responsible. And I can't rely on this as my one gig, and it's not going to keep going. And I have to figure out what other ways to survive. That's where I went with it. I guess it gave me, you know, it gave me some sense of responsibility after being so irresponsible buying all these clothes on tour.
Well, you also have launched a wonderful musical career yourself. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I perform under the name That Rogue Romeo.
Silent hours can become hurtful days.
And I haven't done some music in a while, but I knew if I didn't do any music that it would be my life's biggest regret. You know, back in the 90s, I had a recording contract in Italy when we were on television, and I got a taste for it because they didn't write in English, so they would give me tracks with, like, you know, fake melodies. And then I was just tasked with writing lyrics in English. And I had so much fun. I realized, oh, I do have things to say, and I'm good at it. I can actually sing sometimes better than I thought I could sing. And, you know, and my voice was sort of cut short because of a producer who basically tried to not blackmail us, but strong arm us into getting him a job on one of our TV shows, which had nothing to do with the music we were working on with him. And then just stopped us from singing for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And we were on a TV show, and we had opportunities to sing and everything. We just couldn't. So it was very frustrating. And I started making music again towards the end of those 5 years, writing my own songs with Stefano Borzi in Italy. And the freedom I got from making that music was so addictive. It was like there were things in my body that had been completely unexpressed and in my heart that had been completely unexpressed. And then to be able to share them in a song, I was able to sort of free that space and move forward. Like, it was like a blockage. It was like it was just sitting there until I took that out of my brain and onto this computer. It was like just sitting there on top of my creative life. And so years later, I hadn't recorded for a long time. There was some trauma in Italy, a longer story maybe. And yeah, and I let it go for so many years because it was connected, making music was connected to that trauma. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to do this no matter what. It doesn't matter. I kept telling myself, I'm too old, I'm too this, I'm too that. I'm like, I'm the only one telling myself this. isn't that often the case? We're the only ones telling ourselves, oh, you're too this or too old or too not talented enough, whatever.
Sure.
You know, not a musician, whatever. And yet I can still create songs I need to create because they're in my head and I can dance them out for somebody or I can sing it out for somebody, mm-hmm. even if I can't play it on a guitar. So I took it on and it was incredibly, incredibly freeing.
Oh, great.
So freeing. Yeah.
So you have all of these experiences from being a dancer to a singer to a choreographer to producing things also, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And how does that manifest in the next phase of your career?
Interestingly, they all seem the same. I think mm-hmm. if you approach your art with all of yourself, then everything you're approaching is just more of the same. Like you're still accessing the same muscles, the same creative muscles to do. You're just applying them in different ways. Like for me, I thought, oh, you know, making music is going to be so different from dancing. No, not at all. It's still about rhythms and timing and, you know, and getting on stage. I was like, oh, this is going to be so different from standing on stage behind this other artist. No, I was giving all of that already. It just literally just now I have to like work on some breath control and that's it. But totally comfortable on stage, all of that. I just applied it everywhere. I think moving forward, there's a sense of being retired from the rat race, not retired. Cause I'll never retire. Cause I love what I do.
And yeah.
I can't imagine my life not being creative and doing things, in my business, even just because it's my circle of family and friends that I get to work with. Mm-hmm. But it's the sense that, I used to fight for gigs, not just for the joy of doing the gig, but also because I had to pay my rent. I had to earn the money to do this. I had to get this job to,
right.
you know, for whatever reason. And that's not there anymore. Thankfully, mm-hmm. I'm in a position where I'm not desperate to do anything. So now I can actually focus on things that I'm committed to and really enjoy and also be available for projects that maybe don't pay. Don't say that to anybody. Shh, nobody heard that.
But I understand what you're saying. You're saying that you've elevated to a point where you're kind of going back and reconsidering what art is in a sense and who you want to work with and why you want to work with them.
Absolutely. My focus is different. My piece around what I do is different. My inspiration for things is different. I feel more centered, more balanced. I feel more open to pursuing projects that before were simply personal projects. And now it's like, well, no, that's my focus because that's what I want to do is express myself. I'm not concerned with earning the paycheck out of it. Mm-hmm. It's lovely to earn a great paycheck, but I'm more concerned with staying creative and enjoying what I do. And I can declare that all the time. I can always say, oh, I'm having a great time in this, or I can do something, even if the gig isn't obviously wonderful or inspirational, or whatever, I can make it that for myself now. Mm-hmm. Those are skills I've learned over time. I can find inspiration in things that maybe I couldn't find before. Mm-hmm. But there's also things that I'm like, I'm not going to put up with that.
Yeah.
Or I'm not going to, you know, that's not worth it for me at all. There's definitely those kind of gigs. But usually it's me jumping in on behalf of others. I'm like, oh, no, you need to ask for more money, have better working conditions. No, you need chairs. You need an extra day of rehearsal. You need safety involved.
Right.
You need, you know.
Were there ever moments where sort of like this rat race, getting stuck in the rat race, ever cut into your love of the craft?
Yes, 100%. Mm-hmm. Me trying to recreate and reinvent my experience in dance has been an ongoing challenge.
Uh-huh.
There's definitely been several moments where I'm like, I'm done dancing. I'm done moving. I'm done with this business, you know, screw everybody. And it usually wasn't like, I don't say screw everybody. That's never my focus, but, there was a time on Motown Live where it was a Christmas special and we were doing this lovely, fun Christmas dance and the curtains were closed and I'm back there, you know, I have a teddy bear sweater on and I'm about to go like, whole dance, and I was sitting in that chair bawling, crying my eyes out. I just couldn't believe, you know, some of the ways we were being treated and spoken to, and I knew they didn't even want me there because I was too white, and you know, I was the only, me and the girl that was too black, uh-huh. were the two people who stayed and did every single episode. But it was like, it was just like coming from Italy where I was being treated like a star, you know, and, uh-huh. and at all the benefits of being a celebrity, you know, to coming to being treated really like not well on this mm-hmm. set was challenging. And I was like, I don't know if I can do this. Uh-huh. And I had a total breakdown and then had to just like turn it on.
Right.
And here right. I am, I'm back. There's been a few moments of those over the years where I was really like, you know, I have to recreate why I'm here. Some of that was with auditioning. I would go to auditions and just be suffering like, fuck this audition. I don't want to go to these damn auditions. And it took me reframing my audition experience to actually enjoy going to auditions again, which was really to go into an audition with a different intention than getting the job. So my focus even then was not getting the job. It was about, oh, I'm going to make the casting person laugh, or I'm going mm-hmm. to have a conversation with somebody in the waiting room that empowers them somehow to have a better day, or I'm going to help the casting director find the person they need. And it doesn't mean that I'm the person they need.
Mm-hmm.
But more often than not, that gave me such ease around the audition and presence that I would often get the job mm-hmm. just because I was more myself and more present, and I didn't have that on the line of I have to have this job.
Mm-hmm.
So for myself, I'm constantly now trying to let go of that sense of I have to have this job, because that doesn't help the creative process.
You know, you seem to be very much a perfectionist in all that you do, right? Because, you know, you're always at such a high quality of artistry. And, you know, that drive, has it been a detriment in other parts of your life? Or is it sort of the thing that attaches to you and causes you the most pain at certain times?
No, it's definitely detrimental. It's interesting. You won't see me share much of my own work. Because I'm not satisfied with it. So I don't even want to share some of it. Because I'm like, mm-hmm. well, that's not even representative of how I feel inside or what I wanted it to be. So I'm not even going to share it. I'll share like other people's work with me in it.
Uh-huh.
That's why you see a lot of me, like my resume on my page and stuff. But it's interesting. I've noticed that I don't like to share my choreography or jobs that I'm doing or visuals very often. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm like, nah, could have been better.
Uh-huh.
And that gets in my way. It gets in my way because it could always be better. That's the whole point of doing right. work.
Right.
It can uh-huh. always be better. You just do what you can within the time that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely stopped me from doing certain other areas of work and certain projects. And like, if I can't be the best in the world, like instantly,
mm-hmm.
then sometimes I won't even start. Mm-hmm. I mean, thankfully I can be really, really good, really fast. And so that's helpful to me, but it's definitely in my way. It gives me a connection to excellence. You know, I always say strive for perfection and achieve excellence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where I tend to go. I can't let go of the perfectionism. I will look at like, oh, this hand should be here or not here. Like and those little things like drive me crazy. That's like an OCD around movement and dance.
I totally understand. I mean, I so understand. Like, I'll be in rehearsal and I'll look at a dancer's thumb in relationship to like their fingers and hand, and I'll have to stop rehearsal and be like, can you just move that thumb like 1 inch towards your index finger? And people will be like, oh my God. But yeah, I totally understand. I share that OCD quality. It's like, yeah, it's just like sitting and watching movement. It is one of the most enjoyable and one of the most painful things that can happen for for a choreographer and dancer.
I can't let go of it anymore. So if I'm watching a piece, like if I see anything, like I'm at the same time observing me being entertained by the same piece that I'm analyzing and criticizing while I'm watching it always. Right. And it's the same with movies, editing and pacing and live shows and stage shows. And like, I can't stop thinking like, oh, that's a missed opportunity. Oh, this would have been more powerful if this had been there. This would have, mm-hmm. I don't understand why that went there. This should be here. Like, I'm constantly, that's where I go in my head.
Right.
You know, and it's all, sometimes it's energy flow. Like, I know, you know, as a choreographer, the dance, if you're lost in the energy flow and uh-huh. your brain is being swept up by it, like physically, I'm emotionally, physically swept up by the energy flow in a dance.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone's out of place, someone's out of time, someone's energy is in a different realm. It's like seeing a firework in the corner.
It's like a strobe light going off, right?
Who left their flash on their phone? What, turning on your phones in the movie theater? Like, it's that kind of like,
right.
Like, oh my God, over there, that energy is like, it's like blocked.
Yeah, I totally hear you completely. You know, the last 2 years have been so bizarre, haven't they? I mean, in terms of this great quieting that has happened. And, you know, I found myself really reconsidering how to best choreograph, how to best get my work out there. You know, all of a sudden we had to go to digital platforms for a long time, and, you know, we're finally back to live performance. But it just made me think about a lot of things, think about how I grew up, think about what was fundamentally important and not important. And I think that's happened to so many artists, right, during this time period. And I feel like I've come out of the last 24 months like a very different person, in a sense. And have you felt that there was some major kind of emotional shift that happened during this time?
I want to say I came out of it with a movie script and a new piece. But no, that didn't happen. Emotionally, well, it was very interesting to me that when everything stopped, it wasn't like my life changed that much. And that's when I was like, oh, am I retired? I had to think like that. Am I retired? Because like everything is really about the same. I've definitely come to a different relationship with death. I mean, obviously suffering is always a catch me. This idea of suffering drives me crazy. But like, I've found a lot more peace around people passing. Not that I have a million people pass in my life, but I think that awareness of mortality and health and all of that had me in that conversation for this entire 2 years. I lost my ex-fiance about 4 years
ago. Oh, I'm so sorry.
He took his own life, and it was a rough time. And it wasn't getting better until I think in the pandemic, it was like, oh, when suddenly I'm in this quiet space and I'm just here by myself. And it was then I realized that I can still hear him in my head all the time. I don't feel like he's gone because, like, I don't feel the loss of him because he's in my heart and in my ears all the time. And it took that quiet to hear that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And so I found a lot more peace around that space. And also in, you know, there was a moment of depression early on where I was like, I'm going crazy in here. And then I was because I was supposed to be on tour that whole first year. And then I realized, oh, I've had this moment to be with my then 14-year-old dog all year. I was upset about leaving. And I was like, you know, literally spending every minute I could, like holding my dog with my dog. Like, I didn't want to miss a moment because I knew the time would come when I would give up anything in my world to have a couple more minutes with her. And getting clear on that little bit of happiness and gratitude shifted how I felt about being alone in my space and how I felt about the pandemic and about kind of everything coming to a standstill. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's gratitude of these small things and little things that mean everything.
Right. It's interesting trying to reconfigure the energy of a space that you live in when there's been loss, you know, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Because what I have found when I've lost friends and also, of course, like a greyhound that I loved very much as well, it's like I was so amazed by the amount of energy loss that was like in the space and how long it took to feel that a space I had lived in for 20 years was like mine again, you know? So that's a journey.
I still haven't gotten over my grandmother passing, you know, even like just yesterday, I was like, I want to call my grandmother right now. You make me cry. it's literally right on my sleeve, even to this day. You know, it's been since 2005. There is this big vacuum. And sometimes you just don't know where to put that energy because there's no replacing it. There's no outlet. And I think maybe that's why music and these other creative outlets are so vital, because that is where that energy goes. Instead of being locked inside and unable to process those, all those things that we're dealing with and processing as a creative, we put that into our work, and then we can let that go out into the world.
Absolutely. There's a real therapeutic quality to it. And, you know, American society, I think, and also Asian society too, right, still has difficulty with conversations about mental illness, for instance. They have a problem with just speaking openly, like, you know, if somebody asks you, how are you doing today? And maybe you're not doing that well today, and you actually tell them, it's like such a turn off, right? Mm-hmm. It's always like, I'm doing great. So there's this odd sort of layering and covering that's built into our society in general.
Yeah, 100%. I see that with my dad all the time. Like, you know, I've had very, very open conversations with him. But then if I just leave him to his own devices, he likes to think that everyone knows I love them. I don't need to call. I don't need to reach out. Everything's fine. Just remember that last dinner we had where everything was great. We had a really nice conversation, and then we're done. Like, and that's like the end of the relationship. And I'm like, Dad, like, that's not how that works. Like, you may be at home, like, happy, like, oh, wasn't that great 5 years ago? But everybody else is like, where did you go? Where did you go? At least half of being loved is being there, being available and being present and sharing. Like, love exists on its own in a vacuum, but that's usually when someone's passed, and then you have to kind of deal with love on its own. But like, you're still here. So outreach, reach out, give love, share love, express love.
Often sort of like the gay male has, you know, a difficult relationship with the father figure, right? It's like, and I even remember when we were young, like, I know your dad sort of wasn't present at that time as well, which was really difficult for you. And have you been able to find certain individuals that have been sort of a replacement for that male energy, that male figure in your life?
My unusual answer to that would be the male energy I found was Madonna.
I wasn't expecting that answer.
You know, it's interesting. Like, she really had, you know, she has a mothering quality to her, but her sort of like strength and aggression is very male. Like, well, whatever, male, female, whatever those characteristics are, whatever her energy was, definitely filled parental space for me. Absolutely. Because she was tough, and she was super smart and intelligent and level-headed and focused on our relationships and there, and like would engage. And I would listen to everything she said so hyper carefully. Mm. Yeah, I think she was definitely stepped in, because I had already been in school in Singapore for so long, and then to USC. It was like I hadn't had a parental figure in my life for quite a while. Mm. When I was in Santa Fe, it was my stepdad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right.
That was a bit of an odd relationship at that time. And I didn't see my dad until my real dad, well, stepdad. I can't say real dad because hello, David's my real dad too. I didn't see my biological father until I was 18. Mm-hmm. And he's stepped in on a fatherly level, but I've learned that my preconceived notions of what a father should be have no relationship to the reality of what a father is. Because a father is simply a human that had you. And all of my fantasies and ideas of what a father should be are literally just that, fantasies. And I just myths of what a father should be, or what I would want a father to be, et cetera. And it took many years for me to know him enough to really get clear on his humanity and limitations and the experiences of his life that led him to be who he is, where he had no emotional support at all. He has no emotional toolbox at all, but he tries. He tries so hard. He tries anything I ask him to. And that's all I can ask of somebody who's just, you know, doesn't have those skills naturally or the instinct to have those. Mm-hmm. He was working to support the family at 9 years old. You know, like away from home, like hundreds of miles away from home at 9, sending money back to his family so they could eat and live. From 9 on, literally until now, he's just, his love language is just food and work. It's not, he's very huggy when I see him in person, but he's not like the phone call reach out guy.
And so he's still a restaurateur?
Yeah. He's retired.
Okay.
He lives out in Adelante in the high desert. And he has this land that he works. And I don't know. He's just working all day long. He's working harder than he's ever worked before. I'm like, you're 84, what, 85? And you're like out there tilling the soil and carrying big 150 pound barrels of corn feed, chicken feed. You know, it's keeping him alive. I'll say that. If I have any kind of even a remote little bit of his genetic material, I think I'll be all right.
That's great. What are some words of advice that you would give to a young dancer just entering the field today?
Believe in yourself more than anyone else does. Don't give up. There's a place for everybody, but it's not going to be handed to you. Don't rely simply on dance for dance. Dance is an art form, and like all art forms, requires that you are informed in life, not just in technique. All arts will inform each other. So get good at life to get good at dance. Be a business person. Understand where your money's going, where it's coming from, how to make more money. Don't leave your business in the hands of others. Try and try again. And a no is not a no, it's a not right now. You are special. You are the only one of you that exists. Your voice and your expression is unique in all of time and space, as someone once said. So don't edit that or cut that off. Lean into it and be as fully yourself as you possibly can. You will always succeed the best at being yourself, and you'll usually come up short trying to be somebody else.
Oh, well, that was beautiful. Those were just fabulous mantras for a young person and for anyone, really. Well, I want to thank you so much, Kevin. It was so wonderful. It's such a joy to reconnect today. And I so appreciate your vulnerability and your openness. And, you know, when I hear you speak, I just can tell that you're really living your life with a real sense of grace. And I really mean that.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in today. Please rate the podcast on your listening platform and tell your friends. Feel free to contact me at slantpodcast.com. It's always great to hear from you, our listeners. Special thanks to our sponsors, the Dana Tasso and Burgess Dance Company, the Cherry Blossom Giving Circle, and the Dedi Liam Gunawan Hickory Legacy Fund. And finally, a special shout out to our trusted producer, Feng Shui Zhang. And I'm a sucker for you.